Welcome back to The Network Effect, your gateway to the dynamic world of financial technology. On this episode, I am joined by Access Fintech's CEO, Roy Sadon, and we delve into the exciting advancements and explore the critical role that the industry expertise plays in Access Fintech's journey. We explore how artificial intelligence is reshaping the landscape of financial technology and adapting our products to meet the evolving needs of the financial sector. We'll also unravel the inherent value of the data at the heart of our operations. But firstly, I ask Roy, what phase is Access Fintech in at the moment?
The maturity cycle of a company, it's a big one. We speak a lot about words like community, which I know you're going to touch on, and network. And companies who build networks have a certain dynamics of their own, because critical mass gets measured by the size of the ecosystem and the contributors, and not just the regular metrics of revenue or number of deals that you sign. And when you start, the value of the network is dramatically less than a normal software company, because I'm on my own, so what's the value in there? So you're really looking for hardcore entrepreneurs that sit within the bank who really have that long-term vision. And as you start growing, it's only when you look back, you start realizing that you hit these milestones that make you a disruptive company. And disruption doesn't mean necessarily that technology is disruption. It means that the value of the network is disruptive, but you're not quite in the network. So it's disruptive because I don't see value immediately. Is it worth the exercise? And you realize that you move from the disruptive component to a much more of an acceptable infrastructure, and hopefully you get to the point that you become critical infrastructure because there's so many participants there and there's so much value that's in the network. I definitely feel like we are now in the critical infrastructure phase where I think it's there's too much value being on the network. It's almost you get penalized for not being on the network, and it's not necessarily where people have are forced to be on the network. It's just too much value on there, and therefore it accelerates transactions. And there are natural banks who are, and buy side, who are early adopters, and the next ones will be the early majority. And there's always going to be the critical mass is going to be the laggards, the people who are waiting to see a success story and don't necessarily want to take so much risk up front. You get to that point where it's an acceptable part of the ecosystem and participants see value. The transactional conversation changed the way that they interact, the questions we get asked, the knowledge about what we do, the amount of data that's already on the system, and then kind of everything kind of changes. Suddenly your day looks different. Your pressure looks different. The amount of evangelical conversations you need to do transform into practical onboarding and practical go-to-market. So it definitely feels great to be in a place that people understand and know Access Fintech and accept it as part of the infrastructure. And then we just make life again by launching new products all the time. And we feel like we're in the same cycle because we're addicted to the uphill battle.
Access Fintech places a strong emphasis on hiring professionals from the banking industry. How does this industry expertise benefit the company and the clients?
I think in general, the founding team, there's a point at which they have to take a bit of a back seat as being the face of the product and let operators and ex-operators be the face of the product, because they speak about things with more credibility. They're trusted by the buying community into what they're doing. In the early days, when there's a lot of improvisation and a lot of uncharted waters and the path ahead isn't quite clear, you need that certain entrepreneurial drive and risk appetite. When you get to the point where the level of risk gets replaced with level of credibility and scale, I do think there's a lot of value in people bringing industry experts and credible people to do that. Now, startups are always kind of, it's a bit of a fascinating story from the inside. You're in a big bank, you feel like a bit of a change. It's always like, well, maybe I should go do a fintech. But then you look at the success rates of fintechs and the graveyard is full of promising ideas. So it goes back to the previous point. You have to get to a certain path where you still need a person from within the capital markets ecosystem that still wants to take a bit of risk, because it's not the same pay structure. It's not the same compensation structure. It's deferred benefits based on equity. But some people have that in them. They just want to take a bit less risk on, is this company a viable company? So when you get to that point where it's viable and you want to hit really a large, higher scale, I think that the hires that we've been able to do with Chris Dower and Fabrice and Craig and Parr, who actually jumped way earlier than everyone, they're all ex-operators from the market. And it just gives a different level of credibility because they just they know what the buyer's going, what the buyer dilemma is, because they've been there on the other side. They speak the language in a different way that we do when we talk about vision.
Can you explain how Access FinTech intends to prioritize and develop new products?
You want to be... We always strive to be in a process where you don't have to rebuild everything from scratch, but there's some repeatability to it. I think the components that we repeat is we know that our sweet spot is in the place where, I call it, there's a supply chain challenge. I cannot fix it as a single firm. My problem is shared with my counterparty for the transaction, with my agent for settlement, with the beneficiary owner who's driving the activity. We all need to change something. Every time it's a supply chain problem, it becomes a sweet spot. And then by now we know that if we can stitch the data together from all the parties, there's intelligence that's coming back. So when we started in security settlements, we didn't know why we picked it. The banks came in and said, you want a problem of data collaboration? Security settlements. Now that we're there and now we're seeing that we've solved a lot of the issues, well, SSI is an extension of and is part of it. It becomes like a natural extension for the same problem set. So now we're talking to participants and said, hey, remember how data collaboration helped you before? Now we're just doing the next thing. The next thing is SSI. And the next thing is inventory alignment. And the conversation is a more of a natural progression of let's do more. We don't have to educate about why data collaboration is positive, why the data infrastructure is segregated and protects your data. All these infrastructure components that took years to get over. Now it's about, is the use case big enough? Is it distributed enough across multiple parties? Does it classify that I can't fix it myself? Okay, let's go after it and do it. SSI is specifically gratifying because it's a natural continuation of what we did with security settlements. But then you look at the other things we're doing on derivative payments or on syndicated and private credit loan space. There we did have to go through a bit more of an education cycle about the value of the network. But again, it's not like the early days. There's a lot of... trying to think what the right description is. There's a lot of collateral out there that you reuse over and over again, and an understanding of the industry. And back to that acceptance. Oh, Access FinTech, yeah, it's part of the infrastructure, of course. We know it, we use it in other places. It becomes a much easier conversation.
How does Access FinTech approach the task of teaching clients what the data network means for them?
It is a challenge. You almost get sometimes typecast into a problem set. And if you have bigger visions than that, you suddenly sometimes hit ceilings that are not your own ceilings, but what the perception of the industry is placed around you. So the reason that we moved so quickly and expanded out of securities into loans and payments, even though securities was such in early stages, we didn't want to be typecast into, oh, it's a securities company, because we're not. We're a data company that provides insights, and we just happen to do it in securities. But I don't want people to think that, oh, it's another company is trying to prove that they can be cross-asset. There is no asset component to what we do. But the same thing came to other messages, and you run into it all the time. Oh, you're the company that reduces emails. Like, that's a value proposition of what you do when you collaborate, but that's not what we've kind of tattoo on our arm, saying, hey, we're the email compression company. It's a fantastic trackable value add, but it's one of the benefits you get from collaborating with others. The others include RWA impact and capital release and transaction cost and operational efficiency and email compression. But because that was a key part of our story on day one, it's amazing how long it stays with people, and then you have to unwind and say, hold on, that was just an example. So securities was an example. Email compression was an example. It's about data collaboration. So I do think that we're getting to the point that people understand data collaboration as an objective opens up a lot of opportunities in different assets, measured in front office terms and middle office terms and financing terms. So from that perspective, it's great. But yeah, you can't stop without education, as you said, because when you do, it's like people fall into one of the values that we do, and it's hard to get people extracted out of that pigeonhole, or extract ourselves out of the pigeonhole. Yeah.
How can we utilize artificial intelligence to enhance fintech solutions? And where can it go?
So in the same way that collaboration is a massive category, so is AI. There's so many different models of AI. And everyone kind of gets typecast into, oh, let me just type a query and get a magical answer for my problem. AI can be robotics, and AI can be automated scripting. AI could be self-improving. AI could be complementary to a manual process. AI could replace a manual process. There's so many components to that thing. I would say that in the category of AI, I'm improving so many manual processes using data that I'm, you know, I don't think we're positioning ourselves strongly enough in the AI camp because of what we're doing. I'm using data to improve process and continuously improving that based on the result set and based on the shared information. So it's always there. I think the place where I get a bit nervous about AI is when people expect AI to be a magic solution. And the less educated you are about it, the more you think of it as a magic solution. People don't understand how much training AI needs, how much knowledge has to be in there already, how much bad data can influence, how much course correction you have to do. It's not like you just throw an engine and it just gives you right results. There's a lot of activities around it. I always say it's like, for me, it's easier to use AI to get from 99% efficiency to, from 98% efficiency to 99, than from zero to the 99. It's not like a magic cure you throw on it. There's a lot that has to be done from an infrastructure perspective to have access to data and quality data and a result set and a history to achieve that. But sometimes that last 1% is the one that really takes forever, and then you can use the intelligence of the mass processing and the common knowledge and the scenario testing and statistical analysis, and those models suddenly help you identify corner cases that were much, much, much harder to model it as a human devised rule set.
Are we an AI company?
So the simple answer is, of course we are. I'm using data to predict the future. I mean, what can be more AI than that? But it is what we do, right? I'm using data to say, listen, in 2 days' time, you're going to have a problem that you can eliminate, or you have an opportunity that you can harness. But like everything, you break it into individual small steps. Here's the data that I need. Here are the contributors that I need to have. Here's the intelligence that happens. Here's the missing components. And you sprinkle a bit of predictive analytics on top of it, and you get a full solution. But you can't disconnect the more linear components that are part of the story into that one. But, you know, if I had to just look at the cover of the book, I'm using data to predict the future.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Network Effect. I hope you found our conversation with our CEO enlightening. Thanks to Voya for taking the time to speak to me. Stay tuned for more thought-provoking conversations and the latest fintech trends. Thanks for listening to The Network Effect.